Welcome. I'm Jeff Tom, and I would like to call to order the first general session of the Spring 2008 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. All right. We have a lot to do today, a very full agenda, as we do all weekend. And to start it off, I would like to have, and it's very fortunate today that we have back for a second time, for our invocation this afternoon, Rabbi Reuven Taff of the Mosaic Law Congregation in Sacramento. Mr. Taff?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be here with you, Jeff, and continued success to you and to the officers for the California Council of the Blind. It's an honor to be here with Councilman Steve Cohn of the City of Sacramento and the important work that he does for the citizens of our city. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to be back here again. And I just want to say that today, as I invoke, which is what I'm supposed to do, I want to talk about two individuals who are two people who I think are familiar to all of you. About 7 years ago, a man by the name of Eric Weinmayer became the first blind person, as many of you are aware, to conquer the tallest mountain in the world. And when, you can applaud him. And when he was asked about this accomplishment, about this feat, he said, and I quote, "I was confident I could do as well as anyone who goes to that mountain, and I knew I could turn back gracefully if necessary." And just 5 years before he achieved this incredible feat, 15 climbers died in a storm that trapped three groups near the summit of Mount Everest. It was Everest's worst death toll for a single year. And despite the tragedy and being criticized as a potential liability for his climbing team, Eric said, and I quote, "I refused to be the weak link of the team. I wanted them to put their lives in my hands as I would put my mine in theirs. I would carry my share. I would contribute as any other team member. I would not be carried up to the mountain and spiked on top like a football. If I were to reach the summit, I would reach it in dignity." End quote. He was given the name Superblind, or Blindenheimer, by many of his close friends. And this individual is not only the first blind person to reach the summit of Mount Everest, but also one of only about 100 people in the world to successfully summit the highest peaks of the world's seven continents. I want to just share with you that in 2004, Eric and the team that he was with when he climbed Mount Everest went to Tibet to train blind students on a climb to the Rambuk Glacier on the north side of Mount Everest. And in a country that believes that blindness is a sign that evil spirits are present, Eric challenged those local superstitions. And here's what he said. He said these were blind kids who were told that they had evil spirits inside them. Kids who were tied to beds in dark rooms. Kids who were sold in and out of slavery. When he's not climbing or at home with his wife and daughter, he's usually speaking, and he still climbs about 50 days a year. What an inspiring man. What an inspiring human being. There's one other inspiring human being who you all know was ascended to the governorship of the state of New York about a month ago. Governor, now governor, former lieutenant governor, now governor David Paterson of the state of New York. Many of you don't know that aside from being legally blind, maybe you didn't realize that Governor Paterson was known as a very good basketball player. Did you know that? Well, the New York Times reported when Governor Mario Cuomo was playing basketball against Mr. Paterson in a charity game about 10 years ago, Governor Cuomo said David Paterson was on the other team and I had to guard him. And then Governor Cuomo said to Governor Paterson, now Governor Paterson, he says, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be blind. And he said, I'm guarding you. And Governor Cuomo said, just what I wanted, a blind guy to guard me. Anyway, the second time down the court, David Paterson stole the ball from Mario Cuomo. And you know something, in a story a number of years ago from the Associated Press, quoted Governor Cuomo discussing David Paterson's basketball skills, and this is what Governor Cuomo said. He said, you know, David Paterson has got some kind of sonar for the basket. Ladies and gentlemen, let me conclude by just saying that belief in oneself is the key to living life as an independent, productive, blind person. Without self-confidence, no amount of rehabilitation training will make anyone who is blind self-sufficient, or for that matter, anyone who isn't blind. You know that the New York governor's inspiring story and Eric Weinmayer's story, the first blind person to conquer the tallest mountain in the world, these two people set an example for all blind people because these two people believed in themselves and they found ways to overcome obstacles. My prayer on this day, as you gather today, members of the California Council of the Blind, my prayer is that all of you will continue to strive for that self-confidence with the knowledge that you all have the ability to conquer those mountains and obstacles that are there in the way. And may the California Council of the Blind continue its important work in being that strong advocate in the California legislature and an advocate for legislation in the United States that will address issues of concern to blind and visually impaired Californians. May we so live, and let us all say amen. It's an honor, and thank you so much for allowing me to be here today.
Thank you, Rabbi Taff. It's just so excellent to have you here. We hope we can do it again. You're just a fine representative of this community, and we thank you for coming again to our convention. Let me get on to our next speaker here. To welcome us, we have the Vice Mayor. Oh, we have our Pledge of Allegiance. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a good thing I have my audience to set me straight out there, or else I would...
I was ready to come over.
Yeah. I have to introduce her again tonight, so I really need to get on the stick here. For our Pledge of Allegiance today, we have the president of the Redwood Empire Chapter, Ms. Pearl Brown.
Good afternoon. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Burl. Okay. Now, we will get on to our next speaker. To welcome us, we have the Vice Mayor of the City of Sacramento, Steve Cohn. I will give you a short introduction of Steve so we can get on right on to him. He has been on the Sacramento City Council since 1994 and took over this year as Vice Mayor. He has a bachelor's from Yale, as well as a law degree from the University of San Diego. He was a Fulbright scholar, and I'm not going to tell you. If Joni Patchy were up here, she could tell me, she could pronounce all these French names, but I'm not going to try and do that. But he was in France. We'll leave it at that. He currently works as well as on the city council. He also works for the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, where he's worked since 1992. He and his wife, Catherine Travers, live here, obviously, and they have two children, Nicole and Adam. Steve has been a pioneer in this city, and I'm not really going to read from the introduction. I'm just going to just say that he's been a pioneer in this city on a number of projects. They're very near and dear to those of us in the disability community. Most of all, I think, in the transportation area, which is so essential to everything that we do in our daily lives. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce the Vice Mayor of Sacramento, Steve Cohn.
Well, thank you very much for that very gracious introduction. And I do want to welcome everyone here to Sacramento on behalf of the mayor and council of Sacramento. And also it's a twofer for me because in addition to being vice mayor, I am also a city councilman for this particular area. So welcome to my council district as well. It is a tough act, though, to follow Rabbi Taff. You can see why he has a very devoted following at Mosaic Law. He's quite an inspirational speaker. And can you hear me in back okay? All right, so the mic's working. Let me ask those of you here in the audience, how many of you have come from out of town to the convention? Wow, quite a few. It's I really want to welcome all of you. Of course, I want to welcome my hometown Sacramentans as well, but they're not spending as much money in our hotels, and you know, so I really want to welcome you from out of town. I hope you will find Sacramento an enjoyable visit. We are trying very hard in Sacramento to become what we say is the most livable city in America. That is our goal, and that's our vision. But I think all of you would agree with me that a city cannot be livable unless it's livable for all of its citizens, and including those who are blind, including those who have other impairments that make it more difficult to get around. And in Sacramento, we have not always been as friendly, let's put it that way, as user-friendly as we should. And I think we're learning our lesson, hopefully, learning it well, and learning that we need to make our city livable for all its citizens. And part of that means having a good transit system, a good paratransit system. Part of it is making sure that our sidewalks are accessible to all of our citizens. Part of it is making sure we have sidewalks, because I represent portions of North Sacramento, for example, that were built at a time when people just didn't think about that or did not invest public money in those kinds of features. We hear a lot today about smart growth. And, of course, how can you be for anything but smart growth? I've yet to hear a developer say he has a dumb growth project. Although some of them are plenty dumb, but they're not going to come in and say my project's dumb growth. So of course it's all about smart growth, isn't it? But part of what we need to build in to that concept, in addition to making use of transit, making use of centers where people can walk or use their wheelchairs to get around. Part of it also is making even the housing that people live in accessible. And this is, I think, an important issue that we are becoming more and more interested in here, thanks largely to people from the disability community who are making us very well aware of the need to ensure that a certain amount of the housing that we approve in the city be fully accessible. And that is, frankly, not something we've given a lot of thought about in the past. And, in fact, in the past, Sacramento, because of its flood issues, in fact, you'll see some of the buildings were actually had to be raised up. So we now need to recognize that while it's absolutely important that we have flood control, it's also important that people be able to access buildings, including even housing. So you're going to be hearing more and more about that, I think, in all your cities. In Sacramento, we're embarking on a general plan right now, which sets the vision for the next 20 years in our city. And this is certainly one of the major issues that we will be facing. I think it's exciting times this year. We're hearing all about change in our national government. But as the rabbi mentioned, to have a blind person be governor of New York is very inspirational. It reminds me of one very short story I'll mention, and then I'll turn it back to Jeff. But when I was in law school at the University of San Diego, there was a professor, he taught remedies, which not a real exciting subject, but this fellow was a very entertaining and exciting teacher who was very popular among the students and recognized as being one of the best professors at the law school. His name was Professor Simmons. And during the summer between my second and third year of law school, I was to have him for my class in third year of law school. He had a disease which resulted in his going blind. And this happened very quickly. And I'm sure for some of you that may have been the case too, where blindness came on very suddenly. For others, maybe it took some time. But I just sort of made an assumption that, well, since he went blind in such a quick manner over the summer, there's no way he's going to be able to teach law school in the fall. But there he was on the first day of law school, didn't skip a beat. He was ready to teach and went on to continue to be a great teacher. He also ran for Congress. He wasn't quite as successful. Unfortunately, I think he may have been the wrong party. He was at that time, San Diego was a pretty Republican. He was a Democrat. Now, I guess it may have changed since then. I don't know. And I'm not being partisan now. I'm just telling you the way it is. So at any rate, I just thought that was such an inspiration to see somebody who could have, you know, felt sorry for himself, could have maybe taken a different path. But he decided that he was going to live with this, and he was not only going to live with being blind, he was going to master it and learn how to have a very productive life. And I know all of you here have had to deal with similar situations, so my hat's off to you. And again, welcome to the city of Sacramento.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Councilman Cohen. Well, I want to thank Vice Mayor Cohen for coming. It has been a very, it's been a great pleasure to have you here, and we hope that you have enjoyed your stay here.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and I look forward to seeing you soon. Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Okay. Want to have a couple of announcements. I have a couple. Rob has one. We want to remind you that the resolutions deadline is at the end of the close of the general session this evening for submission of resolutions. Another announcement is from Lewis Preston that we want to encourage chapters and interested parties to get information in for the bulletin board section of the Blind Californian. So if you have items of interest, things going on that should be in the bulletin board section that comes out in every Blind Californian, please get them in. Want to introduce one person, if she's in the room, before I turn it over to Rob Turner for a second. Naomi Grubb, are you in the room? Okay, you want to stand up? Naomi Grubb is our first timer for the year from Silicon Valley chapter. And, you know, you've greeted her warmly. Please do so throughout the convention. I want to introduce another first-timer, if he is here. James Forbes, are you in the room? Okay, he is not here. We'll introduce him later in the convention. He's one of our chapter leaders and first-timer as well. So let me now turn it over to our credentials chair, who's doing a fine job, Rob Turner.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. Very. I just have three chapters that I'd like to hear from, make sure that everything's in order. And that's the Humboldt chapter, so I know James Forbes isn't here now, but someone from the Humboldt chapter I'd like to be contacted. And also the Pyramid chapter and Randolph Shepherd. Those are the three. Okay, that was Randolph Shepherd? Okay. And so Pyramid and Humboldt, those are the two I'll be looking for. And also if you have... articles for the Around the State column in the Blind Californian, please be sure and let me know as I do that column.
Hey, Rob?
Yes.
This is Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Did the GDUC ever...
Yeah,
we talked to him about
that. They're
scored
that.
Away.
Yeah. Yeah, they're scored away. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we're going to move on to our first panel for the... day. Our first panel today is Working Together from the Department of Social Services and CCB Forge Ahead. Before I introduce the director, I do, and we will hear from him later, but I want to acknowledge someone in that department who's going to be on the panel and who is with him that we've known for a long time, and I want to give him a little special applause. Tom Lee, who has been to several of our conventions, and let's hear it for Tom. Let's hear it. Okay, now we're going to introduce the boss. And so even Tom would say, boss gets top billing. I'd like to introduce to you a gentleman that Dan and I and Kathy and others have come to know and have great respect for, and we're very glad that he's been able to come today. Director of the Department of Social Services, John A. Wagner. He was appointed... Oh, thank you. Indeed. He was appointed to that position by Governor Schwarzenegger in April 2007. With nearly two decades of experience in human services, he has served as senior policymaker and advisor to six gubernatorial administrations in Wisconsin and Massachusetts. As director, Mr. Wagner is responsible for the operation of an annual budget in excess of $19 billion and more than 4,000 employees in a department that administers critical services. It's hard enough for turning it over with two hands, but with one, it's critical services to aid and protect California, California's most vulnerable populations, including children, adults, the elderly, and persons with disabilities. Most recently, Mr. Wagner concurrently served in the Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Education Services as Assistant Secretary for Children, Youth, and Families, and as Commissioner of the Department of Transitional Assistance. He is responsible for a number of programs in this state, some of which you'll hear about today, but they include foster care, in-home supportive services, adoptions, and a variety of others. Without further ado, let me present to you, along with his staff, Director John A. Wagner. Mr. Wagner?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon to all of you. Can you hear me okay? Yes? Okay. I want to thank you for inviting me to be here today. This is my first convention, and it's really a thrill to be with the California Council of the Blind, specifically at the Spring 2008 convention. So thanks for inviting us. And again, I want to thank Jeff, President of the California Council of the Blind, Dan Kaiser, Head of Governmental Affairs, and Kathy Skivers, who I just had an opportunity to re-meet, for their support of DSS's efforts in improving services to the blind and visually impaired throughout the state of California. As Jeff mentioned, I'm also joined in this panel by two key staff at DSS, Tom Lee, the Deputy Director of the Department's Human Rights and Community Services Division, and Lisa Bandicari, who is Chief of our Office of Special Services and the Office of Services to the Blind. So we're here together, and we're here to present on a couple things, and we'll have an opportunity to stick around and answer a few questions if you have any. Over the past year, it's been really a privilege to serve here in California as the director of the Department of Social Services. And, you know, I look at the awesome responsibility and opportunities we have at DSS with our 4,500 employees and the work we do with counties to administer services to aid and protect California's most vulnerable populations, including children, adults, and elderly and individuals with disabilities. We are proud of the services we provide, including CalWORKs and food stamps. We also do community care licensing, disability evaluations in partnership with our federal partners for SSI, foster care, in-home support services, child abuse prevention, refugee resettlement, and special services to the blind and the deaf. We are also proud of the multi-level partnerships we've developed across the state to help carry out this mission, which is to serve, aid, and protect vulnerable and needy children and adults in ways that strengthen and preserve families, that encourage personal responsibility, and most importantly, foster independence. I am pleased that DSS and the California Council for the Blind are working as partners, and I know that there's a long history of partnership that way predates me, because I think we share a common goal of being committed to and involved in activities aimed at increasing the number of people with disabilities in the California workforce. Both organizations continually strive for the independence, the security, and the equality of persons with disabilities, and especially persons who are blind or visually impaired. I want to just cite a couple of the collaborations that I know have been ongoing between DSS and the California Council of the Blind, including our collaboration on individual case issues involving blind and individually impaired persons, including the provision of information and referral services. I know we've been working together to update the department's handbook of resources and services for persons who are visually impaired to ensure accurate information is provided, to add more resources and services in a wider variety of topics, and to change the format of the document so that it is more has a more broad-based audience appeal. Collaboration on the administration, improvement, and outreach of the Assistance Dog Special Allowance Program, which, as you probably know, involves providing a monthly payment to eligible persons who use a guide, signal, or service dog to help them with their needs. The allowance helps to pay the cost for food, grooming, and health care for the dog. We're continuing to collaborate to work jointly on areas of concern to the blind and visually impaired community, such as
the IHSS or in-home support services programs, coverage of reader services for those unable to read print, providing training to county child protective service workers to make sure they are more knowledgeable and sensitive to their dealings with blind and visually impaired clients and families, and strategizing ways to improve access to homeless shelters for blind and visually impaired persons. We're also committed to the success of activities targeted to increase the number of people with disabilities in the California workforce, such as actively participating in the Governor's Committee on the Employment of People with Disabilities, and I know Tom is a very active member of that, and working to increase opportunity for state employment through the state's Limited Examination and Appointment, or LEAP, program. Now, I want to offer the opportunity, since we are a panel, to open it up to Tom and Lisa to provide any additional information they want to share with you, and then we will be here to answer some questions. Tom?
Thank you, John, and thank you, Jeff, and boy, it's neat to be back. Miss you guys. It's been 5 years since I've been involved with the Office of Services to the Blind, and I think one of the things that's happening right now from the standpoint of collaboration and working together is it's been a 5-year continued activities in terms of awareness and access for blind and visually impaired. I think that's probably the number one goal that Office of Services of the Blind continues to strive for, is to make others aware of the access issues and the issues that blind and visually impaired people face. I'm going to focus my presentation on just a few of the issues and things that we're working on right now. Most specifically, I am a representative of the Governor's Committee on the Employment of People with Disabilities, and I can tell you right now that one of the things and the biggest challenge that we're faced with as a governor's committee is working with one-stop shops here in California. I know that most of you are aware of the one-stop shops and the problems that exist with awareness, access, physical access, as well as program accessibility. We are working with the World Institute on Disability, and I want to let you know that something has come out this year that I am just really, really proud of, and I hope it can be definitely a benefit for you. And that's Disability Benefits 101, which is a benefit planning website designed to help workers and job seekers and service providers understand the connections between work and benefits for persons with disabilities. So this covers the gamut. This is not only benefits with respect to Section 8 or health, but it's SSI, SDI, and the gamut. So it's a very friendly website that allows someone to come on and determine what their benefits package would be if they made a certain amount of money. And so we're really excited about that at the Governor's Committee, because we feel that definitely knowledge and having the ability to know what impact a certain type of job or a certain salary has with respect to benefits is definitely going to be useful. We are also involved as a part of the Governor's Committee with the Limited Examination and Application Program 2, which is commonly referred to as the LEAP program. One of the things that we're doing in the Governor's Committee is we're trying to have state service, the State Department's model, good employment habits. And one of those is hiring people with disabilities and obviously hiring people who are blind and visually impaired. With our LEAP program, what we're trying to do is statewide create a better opportunity for people who have been certified by the Department of Rehab to come in and enter state service and basically use it as an opportunity to get gainful employment and actually, you know, move up the ladder. The LEAP program is an entry-level type of program. So from the standpoint of experience and whatnot, it really gives people an opportunity to get into state service. The other thing that we're dealing with from the standpoint of employment is trying to look at how we can take a look at how we can take a look at the one-stop shops and how they play into providing services to blind and visually impaired. We are definitely being challenged by the fact that the one-stop shops are traditionally not serving people with disabilities, and specifically blind and visually impaired people. And so we're looking at, so how do we make this a coordinated effort between other agencies, other organizations, as well as our one-stop shops out there. So we're working hard with that with respect to the Governor's Committee. Some of the other things that we're doing is we are working with our IHSS program to take a look at the availability of reader services and what we can and cannot do with respect to Medicaid services that are being paid, reader services that are being paid out of Medicaid. We are also, working on the ATSA program, and I'll have Lisa talk a little bit more about that. Our handbook, which is an attempt to try to reach out to those who are blind and visually impaired and as a resource document. And then also, and I have to tell you, this is probably partly due and most to Catherine here, is we have probably been inundated by our Office of Services to the Blind with specific individual cases that we're dealing with. And it's been really neat to get a better handle on what situations the blind and visually impaired people are being faced with and how we can help to alleviate and sometimes eliminate the barriers that you have. Given that, I'd like to turn it over to Lisa, who will get a little bit more specific about those actions I just talked about. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Hi. Again, my name is Lisa Bandicari, and I'm the chief of the California Department of Social Services Office of Services to the Blind. Likewise, as John and Tom both said, I too am very pleased and honored to be here today. I also must say what a privilege it is for me to be in a position as the chief of services to the blind, where I have the opportunity to represent and advocate for the interests of blind and visually impaired persons. And I want you to know I take that job seriously, very seriously. I'd also like to acknowledge, before I provide my information, and thank Jeff Tom, Dan Kaiser, and Catherine Skivers for their assistance during my first year in this position in making me aware of the community's issues, personally collaborating with me on individual cases and projects, and just for their overall assistance in helping our entire department move into action on issues that have a direct impact on the lives of blind and visually impaired Californians. With that, I'd like to share with you what the Office of Services to the Blind does and what it's currently working on and collaborating with the council on. One of the main things that our office does on a daily basis is provide information and referral services. Daily, we get a number of phone calls and emails from blind or visually impaired people. Sometimes they're friends or relatives, and sometimes just people from public or private agencies trying to assist someone with a visual impairment. And although our office doesn't provide those services directly, we do the best we can to provide comprehensive information referral services. And I'd just like to share with you a few of the topics we get, give you an idea. We get often asked for requests for information on taking books on tape and equipment to play them. We often get requests for lists of Braille transcribers, requests for information on the Department of Rehabilitation's Business Enterprise Program, also known as the Randolph-Shepard Act, or commonly referred to as that. Requests for information on care facilities, usually from a visually impaired family member. Lots of requests for information on government programs such as SSI, SSP, Medi-Cal, and in-home supportive services. All the time getting requests for information for different segments of people, seniors who are incurring a vision loss, programs for blind school-aged children, like special child care after-school programs for them, resources for deaf-blind people, questions on transportation resources, how to obtain guide dogs, housing issues, assistive technology vendors, Just January, we got a call about how to obtain ballot materials in accessible formats during the election. And one we handled recently, and I picked up the phone and called Dan right away. Was one of my first contacts, Dan Kaiser, had to do with the lack of accessibility in courthouses down in the Bay Area. Along with the information and resources we provide, our office for a long time, we have actually developed and distribute a handbook of resources for persons who are visually impaired. Get many requests for that. It's a document that contains all kinds of information on government programs, counseling and support groups, recreational opportunities, and assistive technology, to name a few subject areas. And currently, this handbook is targeted to seniors experiencing vision loss for the first time. But I'm sure you can tell, as you've heard from the list of topics that I mentioned that we received calls or emails on, there seems to be a great need for many audiences to have knowledge about resources for the blind and visually impaired. Because of this, our office is currently working on an even more comprehensive handbook that we hope to have available in a number of formats. In the meantime, we're also working on updating the current handbook that we currently have because we realize much of the contact information is outdated. Again, we've been collaborating with the council on this effort. In particular, Dan Kaiser has been very kind to review some of our sections and make suggestions for improvement. The other major function that our office does is to administer the Assistance Dog Special Allowance Program. And one of the main areas we're currently focused on in that program is actually redesigning the automated case system that we use to administer the program, because it's quite old and outdated and runs the risk of not being functional anymore with current technology. And along with that has come a lot of discussions about how to make our forms more user-friendly, available in various formats, and a complete review of the questions we ask to make sure that we're getting the kind of information we need to make sound eligibility determinations. And I want to tell you, we're very aware of the importance of this program to the people who depend on it. So that's a little summary of what our office does and what we're currently working on. And again, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be here today and share with you some of the things that our office is doing. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Before I open it up for questions, will Michael Marlin, are you in the room? If you are, really raise your hand. Okay. And now, do we have any questions for either the director or Tom or Lisa?
This is Tom. I just wanted to let you all know that when we were giving out information about the Disability Benefits 101 in the LEAP program, the Limited Examination Appointment Program, as well as ADSA, we do have copies of that information in Braille, large print, and CD in the back of the room. So Ed's placed that out there for us. So if you want any of that information, it's available for you.
I'm just going to make a comment. We, you know, we lost our reader services bill last year for IHSS, and as Director Wagner and John and Tom Lee pointed out, we're still working with the department to nail down that issue. But you can better believe we are not going to take no for an answer, and we will continue to work on that issue until we get it.
Yes, I'd actually like to expand a little bit on what Jeff was talking about. The reader issue is very important to us. Frankly, the two most important things I need in-home supportive services for are reading and driving, neither of which are covered. So what I'm really concerned about, and I want to ask the director, is we feel that, some of us feel that people with visual impairments, blind and people with visual impairments sometimes, are sometimes not at the front of the list when it comes to in-home supportive services. We really feel, some of us, that there are a lot of issues, including uniformity from county to county. And that's really one of the things I'm concerned about is how we deal with hours and how you allocate hours from county to county. And certainly readers and drivers, the whole issue of how you allocate hours and what the uses are and such, and how especially we want to maximize those services for the blind and visually impaired, keeping in mind that, frankly, in a lot of areas, the in-home supportive services issue is not seen as a blind issue. Thank you.
I have two issues that I'm concerned with. One is not bothering me at this time, but I did experience it, and it was a nightmare in 2000 and 2001, and that is that I had to deal with EDD. I lost a job in 2000 and had to go through applying for, and now the name of the benefit isn't coming to me, but unemployment, basically. And it was all in print, and there was no assistance. There was supposed to be a handbook. I got it about 6 months after I needed it. I was in touch with Pam Porteous Hunt, who at the time was with the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities, and I didn't. There was even a Sacramento Bee article based on the fact that it was terribly inaccessible. And not only that, after fighting all those battles, SSI took every penny that I supposedly earned from this struggle. So for me, if I ever lose a job again and I'm told to apply for unemployment, I'll tell somebody to go to Hades because I ain't going to do it. Now, the second thing that I have a problem with that is currently plaguing me and my husband and several people in Sacramento County is we are on IHSS, and we are told when we first get our case that we must sign a contract that says we will keep in contact with the timesheets of our workers. We are blind. The timesheets are in print. There is no solution, and they don't seem to care to get one. We are in violation of said contract. I have made, when I became an IHSS client, when I signed the contract, I put a proviso in writing on that contract with my social worker and her supervisor as witnesses that I could not follow the contract because of accessibility issues. And then I was told, we'll make a complaint through the county and do this and contact this person and put it in writing when I had already done so. So I don't know, I'd like to hear by sound how many other people experience this. Oh dear. Well, in Sacramento County, it's rampant, and we need to do something about it. Thanks.
Could I just respond to a couple of the points? First of all, regarding the timesheets, what I'd like to do is bring that information back to our office. We have regular meetings with IHSS. We don't have a representative from IHSS here, but I'd like to bring the timesheet issue back to the office and better understand how we can try to address your very legitimate issue. The other thing, the gentleman prior to you raised some issues about the inconsistency of service levels across counties. And one of the things we have been trying to do over the last 6 months or so is roll out a new process called hourly task guidelines that is an attempt to try to make more consistent the service hour allocations across counties. And in addition to rolling that out, we're also engaged in an evaluator to make sure that it does not have any unintended impacts on service level assignments. So we're looking to try to better standardize service level allocations in the ISS program through this, and it's a fairly new process, so I can't tell you sitting here today how it will end up, but it is trying to attempt to get at the very issue the previous questioner asked about different service levels in different counties. So thanks. Thanks for bringing both of those issues up.
Okay, we have, wait a minute. Kathy, you're second, and you will be last. Actually, we have two in for two questions. Michelle Mason will be first, and Kathy, you will be second, and you'll be the last questioner.
I'm glad you brought up about the time cards, because in our chapter meeting last Monday, we had a almost totally blind a member mentioned that he had an IHSS employee that was telling him that his hours were one thing, and then printing on the time card another thing. And he did not know this for a long time, and then it was brought to his attention. And I want to have somebody come to our chapter meeting to talk about this, because after he mentioned that, two other people came up to me and said they had similar concerns. And I hadn't heard about this before until he brought it up, but that makes a lot of sense. If someone can't see, and they're trusting that the person is verbally telling them, yes, this is the amount of hours I have, you know, how else would they think that the person would be telling them differently?
Right. If you could, I don't know if you're from the same chapter, but if you could make sure that we get your information again. This is the first I'm really hearing of this issue, and I'd like to bring it back to our IHSS staff so that we can figure out what are our options in trying to address this issue, because it is, I completely understand what you're saying.
I'm from San Luis Obispo, Central Coast.
Okay.
Okay. Kathy?
Thank you.
I want to tell you that this is my 59th year attending organizational meetings of the council. So I've had a chance to see and meet a lot of people who are working in departments. And I've become discouraged in the last several years, because sometimes we talk to people and they don't hear us and they're not interested and they don't want to. But I want to tell you that I spoke to Lisa Bandakari recently as a member of the Ellen Murphy Trust Fund. We had a lady we couldn't help. And you know, and I hope you understand, that this department here, these people here today, are the oversight for the counties. And I brought a very critical case to her attention. She said someone would be in touch with that lady. She was the next day. I wish that we could get as much cooperation from people as we have gotten from this group of people in front of us today. And it's been my experience with Tom Lee and now Lisa, and I haven't picked on John too much because he's kind of new and I want him to get acquainted first. But I have been so impressed with his openness and his willingness when Dan and Jeff and I met with him, and with all of that, he brought all of his heads of his departments in. We don't get that kind of reception every day. So what, you know, we need to do is tell them our problems, let them know what they are. But you know what? We have to step up. You've got a governmental affairs department, crisis fund. Tell people what you need. When we sit home and, almost used the wrong word. If we sit home and complain about what's happening, it doesn't get it. What we have to do is come to these people. And I should be asking you a question. And I guess I will. I hope that you will continue to work with the council. And will you come back? We sure hope you do.
Thank you, Kathy. It's quite an honor for all of us to be here, and it's a privilege to work with groups like this. And I just thank you for the invitation, and I would love to come back, as I know Tom and Lisa have in past years.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Before you get away, and I just want to echo what Kathy has said. These, you know, state employees, and I'm one, so I know this, often get a bad rap. But these folks really show what public servants really and truly are. These are really outstanding. I just think Kathy has hit it right on the nose.
Excuse me, Jeff. Jeff, excuse me, this is Tom Lee, and I just wanted to kind of address overall that we continue to work with accessible or non-accessible is probably a better word, issues that you have, and the only way that we know that is when you contact our office. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go on to our next speaker, and I want to provide you a little bit of information because I'm sure that we're going to hear from this gentleman in many years into the future, and it's really an honor to introduce Mike L. Marlin, the manager of the Braille and Talking Book Library for the California State Library. Mike happens to be a librarian who is legally blind. After receiving a Bachelor of Arts in Communications from Brown University in 1987 and working in public broadcasting for several years, he's turning these pages. Michael received his Master's in Library of Information Science in 1992 from the University of Washington. With library degree in hand and eyesight degenerating due to retinitis pigmentosa, Mike embarked upon a series of library jobs in the Seattle area, including the National Park Service Library, Environmental Protection Agency, Region 10 Library, whatever. He says I can skip that. and county library work as well. In 2000, his blindness became such that he learned Braille, and that in itself is an excellent achievement, and started using assistive technology. In 2001, he became an adaptive technology librarian for the Seattle Public Library's Library Equal Access Program, while simultaneously working as a counselor aide for the Washington Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. He went on to work as a collection development and outreach librarian at the Washington Talking Book Braille Library in 2004. Now, we call those reader specialists or something like that, don't we? We have a little less fancy title for that. But they do the same outstanding job. And moved to Tucson, Arizona in 2005 to work as an outreach and special needs librarian for the county public library. Mike and his wife, Debbie, and their feline companion, Zen, relocated to Sacramento in September 2007, where he began managing the Braille and Talking Book Library. He's blushing over here. Michael is very passionate about Braille and Talking Books, and many other things as well, including music. So, before I take all his time away, let's hear from our new managing librarian, Michael Marlin.
I have a mic here.
It's okay. This one might be better.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, and greetings, everyone, and thank you for that long-winded but very nice introduction. Before I start, I just want to apologize in advance. I just was at a Keystone Library Automation System Users Conference in Cincinnati, Ohio, and due to airline difficulties, didn't get back till about 2:30 a.m. last night instead of yesterday afternoon. And so I've had about 12 hours to sleep, eat a little bit, and put my notes into Braille. And so hopefully they're not too convoluted, and I can present something that's clear and understandable. We'll see. As I want to just briefly thank Jeff, thank Gene Lozano, who contacted me, and Dan Kaiser, who I met, who came to our Pratt Smoot celebration back in March, or actually February 29th. And I look forward to meeting most or all of you at some point in the near or far future. I really like to meet everybody who's part of the consumer organizations. Everybody out there has something valuable to contribute. And so I would look forward to that. So what I came to talk about, well, there's so much to talk about, and I probably won't get to all of it because I want to leave some time for questions. But I want to talk about a little bit about our library as well as the NLS, National Library Services, impending digital books program, and then answer questions. So real briefly, I manage the library out of Sacramento, and we cover the 43 counties in Northern California, and we have the two sub-regional libraries. And I'm sure some of this is redundant, and I So I apologize for that. Fresno runs out of their public library, as well as San Francisco's Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, which is out of San Francisco Public Library. And then our counterpart in Southern California, and I'm sure some of you are here from down there, is the Braille Institute of America. Wonderful people. And my counterpart, Henry Chang, who manages that wonderful establishment. And we do plan to start working together more closely and developing more outreach, some statewide outreach and other programming initiatives as well. So stay tuned for that. Our library, I'm also a state employee, and hopefully that's a good thing. And what that means, of course, is that we're operating within state budgetary constraints, and as many of you know, this next couple of years is going to be tricky. Luckily, most of our funding comes from the federal government, and we're not going to be too terribly impacted, although we have had to put a couple of positions on hold, and that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. Let's see. What else can I tell you? And you heard a little bit about my background, so I won't go into that too much, other than to say that I like to joke that, kind of like Cy Sperling with the Hair Club for Men, I'm not only the manager, but I'm a member too. So I actually subscribe to Talking Books, and I have for many years, as well as Braille books. And so I'm aware of some of the advantages and some of the disadvantages with the technology that's getting rather old and antiquated. And I'm aware that staff is, the services, patrons around the country are. And hopefully that's all going to change in rather quickly. So let me move into the digital Talking Books program with NLS, which people have been anticipating for quite some time, and it's just about here. Will be soon. First thing to mention, of course, is to talk very briefly about the budget and budget cuts within the Library of Congress's program for the National Library Service. And I imagine that most of you are kept aware through your listservs or through word of mouth. But just in case you're not, the budget that had been proposed for the Digital Talking Book program had asked for $76.4 million to implement this program in a four-year time span. That's $19.1 million per year. Unfortunately, the House of Representatives cut that amount, and at this point, we're looking at $12.5 million over 6 years, which is, in total, is not too bad. It's only $1.4 million less. However, what that's going to that is going to impact, it's going to impact how many digital talking books NLS is able to produce in this first year alone. For example, the plan had been to produce about 1.1 million digital talking book cartridges, and that number is going to be reduced to about 220,000 due to the budget cuts. So those of you out there who are politically active, feel free to contact your representatives and let them know if you have feelings about that. And of course, this will also impact how long it's going to take to get digital talking book machines out to the folks that we serve. And of course, I feel terrible about it. You know, there's no dancing around that. However, we'll do the best that we can, and National Library Service. The policy is that we do need to honor our veterans first and make sure they get players, and we'll be surveying California Talking Book Library veterans throughout the summer and find out who wants those, and then we'll deal with other folks probably through a lottery process. But you'll be hearing more about that. We are going to relaunch, which has been, it's been dormant for a few years, our newsletter. And we plan to be getting one out in May. And so I have some excellent new staff. I have a new reader advisor, a working reader advisor supervisor, Doug Coronado. And some of you may have a chance to talk to him if you call us. And we also have a new librarian, Janet Coles, who is brings a lot of technical expertise to our program. And so the newsletter is going to happen. Other programming initiatives will happen, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a little bit about how the budget cuts will impact us. Now, the Talking Book Players and the books themselves, I'm sure some of you are curious about those. I can tell you that none of the network libraries yet have these machines, although we've seen them when we've gone to meetings and the NLS representatives have guarded them with the utmost security and said, here, you can touch this, but, you know, they do pass it around, but they keep their eyes on it like a hawk. What will happen is that the plan is that there's going to be a pilot launch program, and that the reason why it's been delayed is mostly due to the budget that I mentioned, and also the fact that because of the budget, the delay is that the contracts, the bidding for the contracts for who's going to produce the players and who's going to produce the digital book cartridges were just received. They're being reviewed. And so decisions will be made in probably April, this month or next month. And then the rollout will begin. Luckily, the players are going to be produced overseas, and it's going to be a fairly streamlined process and should be fairly fast, which will mean that once production does begin, we'll be able to get an allotment of players each month and get them out to customers. The player itself is really neat. It's smaller, sleeker, and lighter weight than the cassette machines, which, by the way, are slated to. Actually, they've stopped producing them. And what was my note going to be? Oh, no, never mind. Get to that in a minute. So the players are really nice. The cartridges are flash memory cartridges. They're trapezoid shaped. They can only go into the player one way. They're a little bit thicker and a little slightly smaller than the cassettes. They don't break. There's no tape to come out of them. They're really wonderful. They're really easy to find if you drop them on the floor. And they're really easy to insert in the player. The minute you insert your cartridge into the player, it starts. The players themselves are designed very much like the cassette machines with the standard buttons. And then there is going to be an advanced model as well, which will allow navigation by skipping through chapters and other phrases. And, for example, if you had a cookbook, you could switch to a mode where you could go down through the recipe line by line and then come back up out to the menu of the cookbook, etc. So most of these books will fit onto a 128 megabyte memory cartridge, and that's it. So instead of having 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, 12 cassettes, you'll have one cartridge. And there are other books that will fit on a larger cartridge, a 256 megabyte. And then I'm told there are 5 books in the collection that will fit on the 1 gigahertz cartridge. So anyway, that's going to be great. The cartridges are white. The containers are going to be blue, whether that matters to you if you're a color-loving person, and there you go. But needless to say, they'll be sent just like the cassettes. Free matter for the blind, and the only difference is that we may be a little bit more forthright in terms of the borrowing period, just because we're going to have a more limited supply of these. So we'll be gentle, don't worry. But some people who've had things out for half a year, we may contact them sooner than we would otherwise. But there's nobody like that out there. Let's see, what else? Let me look at my notes here. So that's a little, and if you, there's lots more, but it's also important to note that the California Braille and Talking Book Library, we've been in negotiation with the state library, and we have secured funds to convert our recording studios from analog to digital. So this is very exciting. We're going to be purchasing a lot of equipment and computers over the next half year to a year, and hopefully build back up our narration program for locally produced books about California and by California authors. And those of you who maybe wanting to volunteer, we will need volunteers for not just for narrating books and for monitoring them, but also for reviewing them. We'll be getting some SoundForge software, which is compatible with screen readers and screen magnifiers. So hopefully we can bring some low vision and blind volunteers back into the program, and I think that's going to be wonderful. So that's very exciting. Those books, we'll find a way to post those somehow for download in conjunction with other libraries around the country who will be gearing up to put their digitally recorded books online. And that leads me to the next topic, which is downloadable books, which was really the sort of the subject of this talk. And I called it BARD. And the reason why is because the National Library Services program is going to be called BARD. The Braille and, Braille and Audio Downloadable Book. Braille and Audio Recorded Download Program. Thank you, yes. There's too many acronyms floating around my head. What this means is that, and some of you may be familiar with a pilot program that's been ongoing for the last year and a half. When the digital books go into production, the NLS website will feature a BARD website. They will combine web Braille books along with digital books, so that you only need one password, and you'll be able to download these books and put them onto your player and listen to them that way. You'll also be able to use the commercially produced players that you can use now with the pilot download. And for the last year and a half, there has been a pilot project. Is anybody out there signed up for the pilot download project? Wonderful, wonderful. So am I. And then you know that there are third-party players that have been produced. There are... Up until the last few weeks, there was only one player that NLS would send an encryption key to, and that was the Victor Reader Streamer from Humanware. But in the last few weeks, two more players have been added for NLS book downloads, and that's the Level Star Icon, as well as the Braille Plus from made by American Printing House. Now, they may or may not be cost prohibitive, depending on your budget. But I think that, and it's pretty well understood that once the NLS program goes live, that other companies are going to fall into line, and some of the other devices that are out there that are accessible, you'll be able to utilize them as well. Let's see. What else? Oh, I wanted to briefly mention some statistics, or sadistics, as one of my library school professors used to call it. There are, at present, 10,028 titles available for digital download from NLS, and there are 500 magazines, not titles, well, 500 different issues of magazines that are available. There are 21 titles that are presently available, and that will increase over the next year. Let's see, other fun numbers. There are 2,058 people that are signed up for the download. That's out of close to 750,000 customers, so it's a very small percentage. We're hoping that that is going to increase. And, oh, there have been about 58,000 downloads transactions within this past fiscal year through NLS. That's kind of neat. And 55 libraries have people that are signed up for the download, and that's only about 40% of all the NLS network libraries. The talking book topics, some of you know that there were announcements about the digital program, and then they suddenly stopped. And that is because I guess NLS felt that since the program hadn't started yet, they really should wait. And once the program is officially launched, there will be an upcoming issue of Talking Book Topics, which will talk more about the digital books, which will list a catalog of the titles, and then that will happen from thenceforth. Oh, I wanted to discuss briefly how the rollout of the books is going to happen. Right now, NLS produces about 2,000 titles a year, RCs, or books on tape, cassette. In the first year of the download, the plan is to do 2,000 titles in cassette and about 650 titles in digital format. Then in 2009/2010, they'll do the same 2,000 RCs, but about 1,100 digital books, and then it will become proportional, and the number of cassette books will diminish, and the digital books will increase. And as of now, they are slated to stop producing cassette books by the end of 2010. However, that is can be reviewed and can be amended depending on the situation, depending on the budget, production, etc. So that's the plan for the outlay of books themselves. And let's see, what else? Well, let me stop here and ask if there are any questions. Before I do that, let me give you my email and encourage you to email and or call me anytime. Communication is very important to me. Networking with folks is really important. Just because I'm the manager doesn't mean I'm that special. I try to be as available, so please do get a hold of me if you need to or would like to talk more. My telephone number in Sacramento is 916-651-0812. You can call us toll-free in the state if you're out of the Sacramento area at 1-800-952-5666. And my email, it's pretty simple, and that's mmarlin, so mmarlin, at library, library, .ca.gov. And we have plans to shorten our URL soon. Right now, our website is a little bit tricky. It's very long. But we're hoping to make it btbl.ca.gov. We'll let you know when that goes live. And so hopefully that'll make things easier for people to get onto our catalog, search for our books, including the digital books when they're available. So, I know I've rambled a bit, so are there any questions?
We only have time for three. We do have other questioners, so only the first three of you are going to be able to...
I'll stick around, too, afterwards for anybody.
This is Perry Wolf, and my question is, are they going to twilight all of the cassette books, or are they going to retranscribe them for the new digital format?
Excellent question. Yes, they are going to begin retroactively converting books, probably more the classics and some of the other popular authors. They plan to do 10,000 of those in the first year and have them available sometime next year for people to be able to access. And then there is a schedule for retroactive conversion over the next 4 to 6 years. So the answer is yes.
Michael, Mitch Pomerantz, and I'm president of the American Council of the Blind, and you commented about if we are politically minded. I want you to know, and the members, that recently when there were hearings in the House regarding the 2009 budget for National Library Service, we did submit testimony indicating not only that we wanted $19.1 million, but we wanted $26 million to make up for the shortfall this fiscal year. I also want the members to know, and you as well, that beginning this year we are going to commence regular meetings with Frank Kurt Silke to talk about issues of concern to blind members of ACB, and we will include in that meeting someone that if you don't know her, Michael, you should. Kim Charlson is our first vice president. She also is your counterpart with the Perkins Library in Watertown, Massachusetts. So yes. Thank you. And Jeff and Gene, I hope you've gotten this gentleman to join ACB.
I will join. Don't worry. I will probably join that other organization as well, just to be fair, as well as many others. Let me just say to Mitch that I'm aware of everything that you spoke of. I've actually been asked to contact Nancy Pelosi's office to try to set up a meeting for California consumers to see if we can get the Speaker of the House to talk with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and other Congress folks to see about whether we can implement that proposal. So just as a facilitator, I have to be careful. I'm a state employee, and so I have to tread a thin line. But yes, I am very well aware. I also know Kim very well. And so... Questions?
No. We're going to do one more, maybe two, but that's about it. Because Mitch's wasn't a question. So,
Michael, this is Jerry Arakawa, president of the California Library Users of America. Glad to have you here. And it's my understanding that the books, the downloadable books, once one downloads them, are essentially yours to keep as a patron. Is that correct?
Downloadable books? Absolutely, yes. Sure. You can keep them on your computer. They're in a special format, so they meet the standard specifications for copyright compliance. You can certainly keep them. You can put them on the mobile players or on your computer. Absolutely.
Okay, final question.
Hi, can you rewind these suckers, one and two? Can you label them, or do they come labeled with Braille?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the digital cartridges will come labeled in Braille. I've seen several of them. They are labeled, and we will also be getting technology to label our locally produced content. And by the way, we have about 400 titles in our collection, and we're going to be getting technology to convert that to digital format and put them onto cartridges. And so, Braille labeling is obviously very important. Will happen.
Great. We are thrilled to hear from you, Michael. We're certainly going to have you back again many times. And we'll certainly work together to help to the extent we can, not only as we have before at the federal level, but this organization is always steadfast behind the library whenever there's been a budget battle, and we'll certainly do it again when we need to.
Thanks, and I'll be in touch with all of you. And if you have, I'll stick around for a while, so hope to meet some of you.
Thank you. Okay. In the interest of time, I am not going to go through the entire rather incredible resume of Ms. Tanya Hoover, Assistant State Fire Marshal, but suffice it to say that our next speaker has a very incredible list of achievements in the fire safety and suppression field. All throughout the Bay Area, her degrees, her certificates, her awards, I could go on and on forever. But rather than do that, I'm going to have our next speaker, Ms. Hoover, discuss with you our topic for today, fire safety for all communities. Ms. Hoover?
Thank you very much, and thanks for not reading my bio. I even get bored hearing it. Actually, I do want to take a couple minutes and introduce myself, and first by saying thank you very much for inviting me to speak on behalf of Chief Kate Dargan, the State Fire Marshal, who is right now at another meeting. It is an honor and a privilege to come before this group and talk about fire safety. It is a very near and dear passion to my heart. I've been the Assistant State Fire Marshal since September 4th, which means 7 months. I've been in this position as an appointee of Governor Schwarzenegger's. And I have to say that the past 7 months have been quite an opportunity, and it compares... I can't compare it to any other life experience so far. I've spent 20 plus years. I never give anybody the details in that 20 plus years because some people are really good at math and then they figure out how old I am. I have spent 20 plus years having the opportunity to take a passion and a love and turn it into a career and a job opportunity. And I'm just privileged to say that every day I get paid to do what I absolutely love, and that is what I call preach the good word about fire safety. And I have been doing this since the time I served as a volunteer firefighter at the age of 14 up until I currently serve as the Assistant State Fire Marshal. The Office of the State Fire Marshal has many, many duties attached to it. We, within the Office of the State Fire Marshal, deal with what we call fire engineering, listing materials for fire alarm systems, smoke detectors, fire sprinklers, etc. We also have a what we call codes and regulations section, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on. But this individual and another staff member go through mountains and mountains of codes and regulations that affect state fire marshal regulated occupancies. I'm responsible for a fire and life safety division that actually is our inspection services that inspect all of our state-owned, leased, and occupied buildings in the state of California, and there are thousands and thousands of those up and down the state. We have what's called a pipeline safety division. They're responsible for pipeline safety. I'm not going to pick on the oil and fuel company now, but maybe later. But their that particular division is responsible for the safety of product fuels that run through the pipelines, and there are thousands and thousands of miles of pipeline that run through California. They're responsible for the safety of that product distribution in those pipelines. I'm also responsible for another area that's very near and dear, and that is state fire training. The state fire training division is responsible for providing training to firefighters in the state of California. And we certify and offer up all sorts of training, anywhere from how to cut holes in a roof. You actually have to be trained on how to do that. I thought I always did that pretty well. To just how to connect to a hydrant, how to pump from an apparatus, and then more of our technical rescue aspects. We also provide training to fire prevention officers and fire marshals and fire chiefs on how to be good prevention officers and fire chiefs. So the state fire marshal gets involved in a lot of different things. One of the areas that we are extremely passionate and engaged in, and that is sharing our mission and sharing fire safety throughout California. And that means sharing it to all communities in California, anyone, and making fire safety accessible to everyone that is within our state, either as a resident or as a visitor. I talked about what we at the State Fire Marshal regulate, and when I talk about regulations, some of those areas are occupancy classes, and I won't get real technical because even that bores me. But some groups that we regulate, and when I say regulate, we write code for are A occupancies, assemblies, E's are educational institutions, H's hazardous occupancies, hazardous materials, our I's, which are called institutional occupancies, but are basically hospitals and residential care, our R occupancies, which are residents, high-rise buildings, and then, of course, our state leased, owned, and occupied buildings. We also then write regulations for fire alarm installation and fire detection system installation, the motion picture industry and studios. I never get a chance to go visit the motion picture studios. I wonder why. I need to do an inspection down there. Fireworks. We regulate fireworks in the state of California. Tents and awnings. And, of course, the wildland-urban interface, what we call our wildland space, all of that open area, the green grasses, the forests, the dense vegetation that is so beautiful right now as it's green. And then by, I'd say here in the next couple months, especially at the rate we're having the weekends heat up, it'll go to that golden brown very quickly, and we regulate occupancies within there. This means that the state fire marshal can write regulations related to fire and life safety in these occupancies and buildings. So what does that have to do with the connection of fire safety to all communities? Well, during January 2007, Building Standards Commission, at the Building Standards Commission hearings, which is where we go forward as the State Fire Marshal's Office for codes and regulation work, during that meeting for our current codes, the Persons with Disabilities community testified in length at the disappointment and disagreement in the current and proposed building and fire codes. I'm here to say that the testimony and the comments made did not go unheard or dismissed. Chief Kate Dargan, our state fire marshal, committed at that time and continues to commit to evaluate every one of those concerns, every one of those comments, and see those through. With that in mind, Chief Dargan at that time established through the Office of the State Fire Marshal an ad hoc access advisory task force. Lots and lots of words, but basically what that means is she brought a group of folks together to address concerns in the disabled communities. This advisory group was established to solicit input to the state fire marshals on panic and fire life safety regulations and to improve all of those regulations for accessibility. The task force, to accomplish this, the task force reviews and what they're doing right now, and they're still meeting. What they do is they take and they review our existing regulations and any proposed ones that are coming down the road. And what this does is it provides the state fire marshal and all of our stakeholders and users. It ensures that our regulations are consistent with all applicable laws and offers the utmost utility and benefit for all of our stakeholders. In other words, providing fire safety to all of our communities. The task force has met several times this year. In fact, they just met in late March, and they will continue to meet. And it's expected, though, that the task force will probably come to a sunset at the end of 2008, and all of those issues that have been brought forward in the task force will be moved forward through our code adoption cycle. In other words, everything that was brought forward or discussed at the task force, the regulations coordinator within the Office of the State Fire Marshal takes those issues and then incorporates those into our, what we call our rulemaking cycle, but our code adoption process here in California as it pertains to fire and life safety. The group has identified several areas of concern. What they are reviewing are areas or items such as areas of refuge and elevator use during emergencies. They also created a subgroup to review and rewrite Title 19, Section 309. Well, I use that term because some folks know what Title 19, Section 309 is, and basically what Title 19, Section 309 is the emergency evacuation signage. It's the tool that helps folks get out of the building. And that subgroup of the task group is actually heavily involved in reviewing that standard, that part of the title, and making appropriate modifications, recommendations. On that particular subgroup are interested parties, persons from the disabled community, as well as signage vendors, folks that are experts in developing signage. We spend a lot of time doing code work, code development and regulations. We do it at the state level, but we also do it at the national level. And why is that important? Well, it should be noted that our adoption and promulgation of our national codes enhance the safety of our disabled community over our prior codes. What being involved at a national level does for us is it improves our fire department elevators. Our national codes are tied to federal access standards. There are active participants by federal agencies in the model code hearings and process. And with the state fire marshal's active participation in the model code hearings, this allows for the development and maintenance of a strong relationship and the ability to forward the concerns of our stakeholders here in California, your voices. It enables us to take your voices to a national level in an effort to bring change to the national code that eventually ends up back here in California. What I like to tell folks is it's a national code with a California flair. There are many, many, many studies out there that the fire service draws from its information, for its information. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, continues to tell us that the best way to serve our community, especially to serve our blind and visually impaired community, is through fire safe practices and planning. In other words, fire drills, establishing fire plans with the community, going one-on-one and talking individually with the community. And that's what the State Fire Marshal's Office is about, is sharing information and talking one-on-one. As I said, that, you know, many studies and reports have told us there's no better method to reduce the risk of injury and death of fire in our blind and visual impaired community or any disabled community than with the use of a meaningful public education and outreach and the continuing of practices of fire safety measures. The use of public education and outreach includes bringing together all individuals that can assist with building our codes, again, the national code with a California flair, and developing standards, and also having your voice help us, the Office of the State Fire Marshal, provide that fire safety for all communities. What's the best way to do that? The best way to do that is to call, and I'm going to give you a phone number if you have any questions, issues, concerns with fire safety. Please, the State Fire Marshal's Office is the place that you can call, along with your own local fire agency and building agency. But here at the State Fire Marshal's Office within the state of California, that number is 916-445-8200. You can ask to speak with myself, or if I don't have the answer for you, I can always find somebody pretty darn quick. And I'll be more than happy to get that person and get that person right back to you with the answer to your questions. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. What I'd like to do now is, one, say thank you, and two, open it up for questions. And if I don't have the answer, I'll find somebody that does.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
Hi, I have a couple of interests in small communities with volunteer fire departments. All three of them complain that they don't have enough people to train the volunteers. There's no money to support them in material. And the people, the younger people, are finding that it's too difficult to find the hours to volunteer. And lastly, that there seemed to be no financial help in sight at the county or state level. Thank you.
Thank you. Funding will always, unfortunately, funding is an issue. The methods of training and providing training and the costs associated with that is a concern. We are working through those financial issues and budgetary issues at a state level, as everyone, as you heard earlier. It is a challenge, and we're also in the business of finding creative ways to meeting the needs of our community. Wished I had an absolute simple answer.
Okay. My question is that as a blind person, I have had this situation, and also I also know of other elderly and disabled people who may not have the resources or the means to find somebody to help them clear the yards of dry grass, hazardous materials for fire safety. So are there any current programs available to us to help those of us who are blind or disabled or elderly who cannot, you know, afford to pay somebody to help clear our yards of fire, just has, you know, materials and dry grass and such?
Thank you for that question. And no, she's not a plant. No pun intended. Gosh, I'm quick today. I must have had sugar for lunch. Yes, there are a couple methods, and I'll give you two off the top of my head, and then, again, I want you to call our office and talk with our Wildland outreach group. First of all, I would strongly suggest that you contact your local fire agency. Local fire agencies have the ability, along with their fire safe councils, to obtain grants to help folks clear vegetation. And your fire agency may have received one of those grants, or the Fire Safe Council that serves your area may have received one of those grants, and they may be able to help you and actually set that up for you to do that clearance.
Thank you.
The other avenue, you know, again, is I know a lot of fire agencies have a list of individuals that do vegetation clearance. And sometimes those individuals will do some gracious, I call it gracious work, where only, and maybe only the fire department knows that. But I, again, I strongly suggest contact your local agencies and your fire safe councils. They're the best place to go to help with that.
Hi, I live in a two-story condominium. And if I'm downstairs when the fire breaks out, there are lots of ways out. If I'm upstairs, there's a stairway. What do I do if the fire is in the stairway other than jump out the window?
You call. You take a long
step. Of course you call 911, but that's no great help getting out of the house if the fire is really going.
You have a great question. And not seeing your arrangement or your situation, what I can strongly suggest is practically every fire agency out there has a public education outreach group that typically will come and meet with individuals one-on-one and talk about two ways out and exit availability and how to best exit your particular residence in the event of a fire. But I have to bring something up. I'm so glad that you came forward to ask the question, because that is the basis of what we just got done talking about. And it's about planning. Everybody here should think about planning. What am I going to do at home? What am I going to do when I visit friends? What am I going to do when I'm in a hotel? It's about planning. And to me, that says, you know, I've already done my part, because she's already planning. She's already thinking about it. But I would strongly suggest that you contact your local fire agency and have them come out and meet with you and take a look at your residence and give you some pointers and some tips on how to evacuate safely and two ways in or two ways out.
They also have throw out the window rope ladders.
Is he kidding? Is that for real?
No, they do. The question was, they have some roll-out window ladders. They absolutely do. You hook them over your window and you throw them out, and typically they run anywhere from 8 to 12 feet long. I have to tell you that you need to practice with those. I have one of those. I have to practice with one of those. You need to know how to put it on the windowsill, how to use it. It's just like anything else. You need to practice first before you actually need to use it in the event of an emergency.
Where can you buy those ladders?
Those ladders are available typically at hardware stores. I bought mine at a very large warehouse hardware store, not to be mentioned, Home Depot. But most hardware stores, large hardware stores, carry them.
They sell them at the business train station. Hi, Ken Metz, and Ken. Thank you. Excellent talk. But in Los Angeles County, we've had, or in the city, we've had areas where we've had some general disaster drills, fire drills and things on a large scale. The problems we've had is they want to get a lot of folks with disabilities at these drills, and somehow, I remember the one I attended a couple of years ago, we had probably 30 folks who were blind or visually impaired, and hundreds of people with other disabilities, and you know what they did with those of us who were blind? Nothing. All we did was fill out papers. We went from one station, but they never concerned themselves with how they would have to work with us to try and get us out of a disaster. They never concerned themselves with what would happen if we have guide dogs and how to help us with our guide dogs stay together in those emergencies. I'm hoping that the state fire marshal's office could do something to at least give, and I know they've been working on state prepared emergency preparedness, but I'd like to see where the state fire marshal will in fact put some type of a mandated situation to make sure that they can take care of all people with disabilities. That was county. It's still part of the state. I think we still have 50 counties in the state. 51.
Thank you. I can't stress enough if you have an opportunity to participate in activities, or even if you don't have the opportunity to participate in an activity, I'm a big proponent of leaving my local agencies know what my concerns are. I was a local for a lot of years, and I welcome the opportunity to have somebody walk in my office and share with me their concerns, their issues, good or bad. So don't hesitate to do that. I consider anybody a public servant should have an open door policy. My local friends are probably outside waiting for me right now, and they're going to throw me into my car.
This is Frank Welty.
Hi, Frank.
Yes, I know that there are a lot of generic fire safety and emergency preparedness programs around the state. But to what extent are you aware of programs that have been designed specifically with the concerns of people with disabilities in mind? And to what extent are you aware of funding that might be available for groups that want to start such programs?
Good questions. I know that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, along with folks at the National Fire Academy, have done programs specially designed for persons with disability. I also, there's an organization, I think it's called Home Fire Safety, did an extensive outreach program to the disabled community. They did a program for the hearing impaired. I believe they also have a program for visually impaired and blind. There are I believe, and I'm having to remember now, but many of these organizations received grants through FEMA to establish those programs, which then when those individuals have the grants to establish the programs that are specific to a user group, that then allows locals to be able to take that information and use it at a local level as well. Again, give me a call. I'll find the group and pass it on. In fact, pass it on to the organization as a whole.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one questioner. Sorry, Paul Patchy, and you'll be the questioner.
It's just a comment. My family and I participated in a disaster last year, and it was very great. I mean, my wife had her guide dog. They wanted to take the dog. She said no. Then they helped her get out with the dog. So, I mean, I know in Sacramento that was my first experience, but it was a real good participation that I felt was really good for the disability community.
I'll share. Thank you for the comment. I'm going to real quickly share a personal experience. I used to work for a large university system in the state of California. I think they called it UC. And in the Berkeley area. I think they called it UC Berkeley, come to think of it. And one of my responsibility areas was to do fire and life safety training in our residential housing. And our residential housing being one of our highest risk groups. We considered those folks to be our highest risk groups because, for the most part, they were students. And, you know, students aren't always thinking about fire safety. They're thinking about Friday night or Saturday night or studying, of course. If you have children in college, they were thinking about studying. One of the things that we did at UC Berkeley with our disabled community is we came together and worked on a fire and life safety plan for the disabled community that involved specialty drills with the fire department, defend-in-place techniques, locations where folks could defend in place, that training not only just from the fire department coming to the dorms and doing or residents' life and doing helping with evacuations, but understanding the necessities of some of our groups of folks who, one, the situation just brought up about you can't take an individual's lifeline, such as their needed mobility, the chair, their partner, the dog, their assistant. You can't just make that decision for somebody. And what I found to be very nice is the fire department was very open to understanding the needs of folks during an emergency. And that came from the community sharing it with the fire department and the fire department asking the questions. So I'm glad that you had a positive experience with SAC Fire. And when I see them, I will tell them that because they need to know.
All right. Thank you very, very much. We are... This is a great topic, Ms. Hoover, and we're very pleased that you could come today. And I want to thank Jean for and others who are on these task forces and are on top of many of these concerns. And I want to thank Jean for having you here today. So thank you again. Okay, before we bring on... Okay, well, you know, these last two speakers for the day need no introduction. And I'm not going to really give them one, except to say that I can't think of anything that has given me more pleasure, other than the membership as a whole, than working with these people during my tenure as president, than working with Linda Dardarian and Lainey Feingold. So let's have a standing ovation for Linda and Lainey.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Back to you guys. We love the CCB and the ACB and all the members and officers and affiliate officers that we've had the privilege to work with over the last 13 years.
And I think, this is Linda, I think what Jeff said about the great pleasure that we get from working with that Jeff gets from working with us, we have from working with all of you. And it really is just a highlight of both Lainey's and my careers to be so connected with all of you and to be able to do whatever we can to make this more a more accessible world.
And on that note, okay, well, and we want to specifically thank Jean, who coordinated this whole session, as I understand it, for squeezing us in. And our half hour is to talk about how we could maybe use structured negotiations to increase accessibility to healthcare information and healthcare generally for people who are blind and visually impaired. So we only have half an hour, and we're going to talk in our usual fast way, but we did want to spend 5 minutes at the beginning just going over the kind of work we've done for access to financial information, because we're kind of hoping that can be a model for all of us as we're thinking, how could we use the advocacy negotiations process that we've used to increase financial service access to increase accessibility in healthcare services, healthcare information. So for that, I just want to say this. For those of you who don't know, the California Council of the Blind has been not just in the leadership, but the leadership nationally in increasing access to financial services in the United States and really across the globe, because so many of the things we're doing here in the U.S., the talking ATMs, those are manufactured by international corporations, and because the California Councils of the Blind's work since 1995 on this issue, there are now talking ATMs not just in the United States, not just all over California, but really all over the world. And applause goes back to all of us in this room.
It's so significant, in fact, that non-talking ATMs aren't even manufactured anymore.
Yep. But when we started, you know, back when Mitch was president of this chapter, and then during Kathy's tenure, and now Jeff's, you know, when we first started, there weren't any talking ATMs in the whole United States. So that's just one example. The kind of access to... And the dogs like it, too. You know, with the banks, hopefully you have all come to count on, and if you haven't, you could talk to us after, you know, being able to receive your financial information in a format that works for you so you can confidentially and privately review your own information either in Braille or online accessibility or large print or audio, have raise line checks, be able to do your banking online by yourself. And these are all things that have come about as a result of ACB, CCB, and other affiliates and other individual blind people's advocacy efforts over the past 13 years. Without litigation, we haven't had to file a single lawsuit on this stuff because of the CCB and ACB and our approach to working with corporations to get better results and deeper relationships with these financial institutions. So we are hoping that we can use this model for healthcare issues.
One thing I'd also like to add is that, you know, a lot of people talk, Lainey says that we haven't had to file a single lawsuit on these issues, which is true. And a lot of people will talk about the importance of filing lawsuits in order to make legal precedent. Well, what we have done and what all of you have done in this technology, access to financial information arena is change industry. You changed industry. Now, what is more precedential than changing an industry?
I can second that. Okay, all right, so we want to talk about how we, some of the issues that we think that structured negotiations might work for in healthcare. We do, in closing out on the financial, want to give everyone the heads up of two announcements that are going to be coming out in the next, hopefully, month. And when you hear them, we want you to know that these are your announcements. These are CCB and ACB's victories. They're the next two settlements that have been negotiated that we're going to be announcing. The first one will probably be our agreement with Rite Aid stores to make sure every point-of-sale device in their stores has a tactile keypad, so no one should have to tell anyone their PIN. And Rite Aid signed a separate agreement at the same time to ensure that RiteAid.com is accessible to people with disabilities, complying with the W3C standards. So those two agreements have been signed. The ACB, the California Council of the Blind, and the American Foundation for the Blind work with Linda and I on those, and we hope to be announcing those soon. And the next thing that we talked in the car, can we say this? And we say, yes, we can say it, because even though it hasn't been signed yet, the ink is almost dry on the agreement that the ACB and the CCB and some blind individuals have been working on to guarantee that credit reports, free annual credit reports in the United States, are available in Braille, large print, audio, and online accessible. So hopefully you guys will be hearing and getting email announcements on these, and when you do, I want you to think of them as yours, because they are. Okay, so moving into the healthcare stuff, let me just say one thing. Because we have the relationships with a lot of the pharmacy retailers, because we've been working with them on point of sale, one of the things that we are hoping to be able to engage with them on is accessible prescription labeling, because... You know, there's no guarantees, but one of the things we like about structured negotiations is it does allow relationship building. And so we now have relationships. CCB has signed agreements with Walmart, Rite Aid, Walmart, Rite Aid, Safeway, who have pharmacies, and we're hoping to... CVS in our dreams also, but
we're working on both Target and CVS.
Yeah, so that is one healthcare issue, and I'm going to turn it over to Linda to talk about some of the other healthcare issues, and then we'll turn it over to you to hear your ideas.
So in addition to hopefully negotiating with the retail pharmacies on accessible prescription information, we're also going to be announcing at the end of next week, hopefully, a settlement with the Sutter Healthcare System on healthcare access issues. And I don't know how many of you know or are patients of Sutter, but Sutter is, after Kaiser, the largest private hospital chain in Northern California. Sutter has 31 hospital affiliates that are not just hospitals but also clinics all over Northern California. And what Sutter is agreeing to do is on behalf of the not only just the corporate entity but all of their 31 affiliates to provide accessible health care and including policy and procedure modifications for patients and visitors who are people with visual impairments. And specifically what Sutter will be doing is they will be making all of their websites, the corporate website and each affiliate's website, compliant with WC3. They will be having signage, tactile signage, in each of their hospitals and clinics. They will improve their policies and procedures and practices on the right to be accompanied by a service animal in all public and patient care areas in Sutter hospitals and clinics. They will have, if they don't already, they will commit to have tactile point-of-sale machines at their pharmacies, cafeterias, and gift shops in all of their hospitals and clinics. They will be providing alternative formats for all printed information on patient care, including printed materials at registration, admission, privacy statements, disclosure statements. Those will all be provided in alternative formats, including Braille, large print, and audio. They have also committed to provide accessible prescription information at all of their pharmacies, including audible prescription labels. The staff at all the Sutter hospitals and clinics will be trained on all of these policies and procedures so that they should now or soon be aware of Sutter's obligations regarding alternative formats, other auxiliary aids and services, and the accompaniment of service animals, and also the maintenance of their signage in proper condition. Sutter has hired Brenda Primo and June Kales of the Center for Disability Issues in the Health Profession to help them implement these policies and procedures and also to provide the training to all of their hospital and clinic staff on these issues. Each hospital will now have its own ADA coordinator, which they didn't have in the past. And counsel for the plaintiffs will be continually monitoring Sutter's compliance with these obligations. That's, you know, us. So you will always have a voice if anything happens at Sutter, if you find that they are not providing you the access to your health care that you're entitled to under the Americans with Disabilities Act or California law, then please feel free to send an email or give us a call, and we will take it up with Sutter. All of these changes should be implemented within the next year or year and a half. There's a timetable for that. But even in the meantime, if anything comes up, please, please, please let us know.
Another thing we want to look at in healthcare, besides the issues that Linda mentioned, has to do with just the basic information. I mean, it was about a year and a half ago, I got something from Blue. I have a Blue Cross PPO, and it's like, you can now get all your health information. They must have had 25 languages, you know.
Bernice, they even have information available in Armenian.
Yeah, so, I mean, they have information available in Armenian, and it just kind of made me think, whoa, someone somewhere recognizes that it is very important to get healthcare information in a way that you can personally understand it and independently access it, because a lot of that information is confidential. Right, they're looking for blind Armenians. That's what Bernice said. So, you know, that's one of the things, one of the reasons, you know, we talked to Jean about coming up here is because I think that some of the idea of access to information has to do with our expectations. And I think for so long things have not been accessible that there's a feeling that, well, I have to ask someone to read this to me, or I can't get this, or I'll have to do it on the phone during business hours rather than on the computer when I'd rather do it at night. So we really invite you to think about the kind of, you know, privacy and confidential information that you are not getting in a format that's effective for you. And, you know, we'd like to open up the floor for your ideas on how CCB can be more proactive with the structured negotiations method in taking a leadership role in healthcare, similarly to having done so in financial services.
This is Frank Welty here. I have a quick comment and a question. First of all, I want to publicly recognize Lainey and Linda here at CCB for their receipt of the Access Award from the American Foundation for the Blind last week.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
And second, do you have any thoughts on how we can sink our teeth into the hide of the 800-pound gorilla, otherwise known as Kaiser?
The Kaiser issue is that's a great question. And I know that there is a settlement agreement between Kaiser and disability rights advocates. I'm not exactly sure what the status of the implementation is. But I think the best thing to do is to give me specific incidents of problems that you're encountering with Kaiser, and together we can bring them up to bring them to the attention of disability rights advocates, because I know that they are still implementing the agreement. They're still monitoring of the agreement. So, you know, there may be issues that the agreement doesn't cover that we could, you know, investigate and bring up independently of their settlement. Or there might be, you know, provisions under the settlement that just aren't being adequately implemented by Kaiser, and they just need to have that brought to their attention.
I'm going to take, I seldom do this, but I think in this case I am going to take a presidential prerogative and ask a question. And that is, what about the issue of, and it's becoming a greater and greater issue, and in one sense it's an issue that may actually be trending in our direction with technology, and that is going to be access to healthcare records. What, if anything, can we do to promote the ability to, because in years to come, healthcare records are going to be more and more, digitized, and you know, there's going to be fewer and fewer hard copy records. But we have to make sure that those records are going to be in an online form that we can access, and the websites are going to be in a form that we can get onto. In terms of, because frequently you have to in order to communicate with your doctor, you have to do it via a website, and frequently those websites are not accessible. So what about those issues?
Well, Sutter in particular is planning on moving towards electronic-based medical records, and they have committed that everything that's online will be accessible under the WCAG guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of brings up a process question that maybe you guys can talk about organizationally, because, you know, we feel strongly that the state and federal law requires websites to be accessible. And we think that structured negotiations is the perfect method of making websites accessible. And we're hoping that when we announce the credit report agreement, because the credit reports will be online accessible, that will be another step towards breaking that open. So in terms of CCB as an organization and how to get the information to us, because obviously we can't take up every single website that's on the internet, but on the other hand, prioritizing what's important, the more, if there's particular, you know, if there's a visual CAPTCHA, you know, something that just shuts down a website where you have to copy those squiggly lines into the box, if you run into those on a healthcare website, things like that, that are real showstoppers that we can really communicate to the person who's operating the site. You know, a blind person, you may as well have a sign up, no no can use. So we need to come up with a way to get, you know, either a through the CCB office, or we can, at the end, we'll tell you our emails again and our phone numbers to, you know, all these things. Jeff, I totally agree with you. The medical records are critical, and the way they put them up really matters. Bernice?
When you're talking about access to health care information, are you going to venture into the mail order prescriptions? We need to have the prescription number, the refills, the dosage, what the medicine is, in some form that we can access. That's one. Two is that I still have not gotten any resolution from AT&T about being able to use the quick service. Three is that I still don't have access to healthcare information as a retiree of the federal government for open enrollment. And four, every time Roger gets on the Bank of America website, which is about 4 to 6 times a month, it's they've changed something. It makes it more difficult. And we used to download the bank statements every month. He hasn't been able to do that for several years, actually, because it's the PDF and the format of it is just not in a form that I find usable anyway.
Well, let me just, those are good points. In terms of you saying, are we going to get into, we're going to get into basically what you guys want us to get into.
Yeah.
So the issue of on mail order prescriptions is very important and has been raised and is something we're hoping to parlay our relationships with the pharmacies, because some of them, like CVS and Caremark, are the same big corporations. So that's definitely already on our to-do list. In terms of banking things, I don't think we should take up time this afternoon on banking stuff. We'll leave our emails, and we do follow up and work with all the banks that we have agreements with. And, you know, you run into problems, which, you know, they're big, huge corporations. I think they're all really trying hard, but stuff does happen. So that stuff, people should call or email us afterwards. Okay.
Humana and Medco were the two that I was.
What's the other
Humana?
One?
Medco
is now doing Braille.
I get all my medical labels in Braille from Medco.
Oh, yes? They have refused me. Okay, but I'm not a Braille. I'm one large print person. So.
Well, they'll do that.
They'll do large print also.
Okay, time for Gene.
Okay. Hi. The Sutter case, I was wondering the policies that Sutter will eventually issue on, like, service animals and other things similar to that, are those going to be allowed to be public and permissible for anyone who would like to see them? Kaiser will not allow that. You can't see the service animal policy, for instance. I've talked to DRA about that. We were involved in that case, and we can't even get access to look at that information. The other thing is, will the case deal with the issue of benefits of getting accessible equipment that, like blood pressure monitoring or glucose, things for the diabetics, be accessible? And I guess the last one, going to my role as a disability management counselor of the university, we have to have medical documentation on a person's diagnosis and functional limitations. Kaiser, for instance, and I know you're not involved in Kaiser, but I'm just thinking about Sutter, the students sign a release giving permission for this information, the form to be filled out. And many of the doctors at Kaiser, and I've not heard yet in Sutter, but just wonder if this is built in, have decided they won't give information here because they feel it's private, and they'll give you a diagnosis but no functional limitations, and they want the disability services then automatically to give you every service based on no functional information, the limitations there. So I'm just wondering in this case whether there's preventative things like that and if there's going to be more openness than in the Kaiser case. Thank you.
Gene, as to the whether the policies will be public, I'll have to find that out. That's a question I haven't asked yet, so I will ask Sutter about that. But as an individual who's involved in the case, you're certainly entitled to see them. So the case does not deal with durable medical equipment, but it's not, just because we're not dealing with it in this case doesn't mean that it can't be dealt with by other people at a different time or by us raising it through a different case or through a different structured negotiations. And I'll need to talk to you more about the third issue you raised.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Beryl Brown, Redwood Empire. Comment more than question. When you're lying in that hospital bed and something is not right, don't wait till you get home. Pick up your telephone and ask the operator to connect you with the ADA officer of that hospital. Somebody will show up at your bedside. I had experiences with Sutter I think you know about already. And it's amazing. People will come and listen to what you have to say. But also I'd like to suggest anytime you go into a drugstore, bug them. Ask them if they have talking labels yet. They'll get tired of listening to you eventually. But also, use these things that we have now have access to. When you go use your ATM machine, ask for the tactile screen, but just don't let them sit. Use them.
Oh, I say amen to that.
That's absolutely right.
Goodness.
That really is the most powerful message of all. When the demand by consumers is the most potent motivator of all.
Artis?
Okay, my question is a little different area. I don't know. Have you gotten into anything with access to equipment? For example, I know a few years ago when I had to go to the cardiac rehab, they would not allow me to use, like, the treadmill, et cetera. And recently, when I went in for my last stress test, they switched me from using the treadmill to using the medication instead. And I asked him why, and they said, well, we just thought it would be easier for you. And I was wondering, when does it become a problem where we can't fight it because they consider it liability, or when is it not? Because I noticed that they have 80-year-old people that can barely walk, and they allow them to do it. And I have no problem walking, but they won't let me. So,
well, some of that is disability awareness, and when we work with institutions, we do try to work that in. Some of it is accessible equipment issues, and a lot of it is just ignorance and lack of training. So that's why training, and again, like the woman before said, you know, you shouldn't have to be an ambassador for all blind people, but in some ways you are. And to the extent that in every interaction you can explain to people what the issues are, the light bulbs will start going off. Next.
Yeah, I'm Linda Amate, and I don't know if this is a question or what you'd call it, but I'm a little concerned about people like some of us who live in smaller communities. We deal with independent pharmacies and so on and so forth. Where can we possibly tell these people? I happen to have a very nice pharmacist who would probably bend over backwards to help me with, say, getting the pill bottle, talking pill bottle labels, that kind of thing. And I just wondered, where could I, if I want to tell him about this, because he may not even know about it, being in a small community and so forth. They don't deal with a whole lot of blind people. You know, they don't have, like, however many are in San Francisco or whatever, you know. And so that's what I'm wondering about. Is there some place that I can contact to where I could say, this is available, this would be very helpful, this is where we can get it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there really isn't, I mean, someone in the audience may know of a... Mitch, do you know the answer to that? Do you want the mic?
Brenda Primo's organization, Western University of Health Sciences. And in fact, Brenda was the one, and I knew about the talking pill bottles, but until Brenda brought one to show me for the cable TV show we do, I hadn't really thought seriously about getting it, and it was because of Brenda that I now did some lobbying, and we now get them at our local Kaiser Pharmacy in Pasadena. I don't have Brenda's information here, but I have it back at work. And you have her information?
I have it too.
Yeah, I'd contact Brenda.
That's good advice. Yeah, I was going to mention this after, but I'll take this opportunity to mention it now, that I now have a website that I have resources and frequently asked questions on it, and you can get to it by going to structurednegotiations.com. And I'm going to put, this is a good question, I'm going to put Brenda's information. I have all the accessible pedestrians. We didn't even mention accessible pedestrian signals. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, talk about a CCB achievement. Ah, yeah, landmark agreement in San Francisco where they have already installed over, I believe, 60 intersections, which is over like 700 actual devices installed. So on the website, I have a section on resources for APS, and I'll put up one for this accessible prescription labeling.
And what would I go into other than the website name, which I just wrote down?
Yeah, well, Brent, the main people who work on policy in this area, it's cdihp.org. cdihp.org. Ken, you're up.
Hi, Lainey, Linda. Appreciate the opportunity. A couple of things. First of all, of course, you remember 3 years ago I had the incident with Kaiser, and I really did win that one within 24 hours. Then they went ahead and charged me $100 for the talking glucometer, which is fine because I had an 80-20 durable medical equipment. However, I wrote to the California Department of Corporations because of the fact that they gave me the print one for free, and I said if they gave me that one for free, they should give me the other one. And but it took about 3 months, but I got the money back. So I won that. But where I work changed health insurance. I no longer have Kaiser right now. I have Blue Cross. They have a mail order prescription place that I use called NextRx. And I talked with them about the talking prescription bottles. They didn't have it, but I have to say that when they sent me my 5 or 6 or 7 prescriptions, they used larger bottles and every one of them had Braille with all of the information. Now, in this case, I happen to read Braille. It would not have helped if I couldn't read Braille, but I thought it was a great move forward. I was really surprised to even get that. And it did have exactly the name, the doctor's name. Well, when I say there, it had the company name, my name, the doctor's name, had the prescription number, the name of the prescription, how many times a day, how many refills, just like we heard earlier, their phone number. And I just thought it was a great bit of progress to even see it in Braille. I appreciated that.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks for bringing it up. And, you know, just like you were supposed to, when you see something wrong, say it. When you see something good, say it too.
Yeah.
Because that goes far.
Hi, I'm Karen. I must express appreciation for the fantastic job you ladies are doing. My domestic partner nearly died in August of 2006. Medi-Cal is a nightmare. They had to pay for her defibrillator / pacemaker because what she had undergone was considered a medical emergency. She almost died. What really makes me very angry, and I know it makes her very angry, is she can't even get a talking glucometer through Medi-Cal. It's on hold, even though our family physician wrote a prescription for it. Now, I want to find out what we can do to get Medi-Cal to get off their blasted hindquarters and have her get a talking glucometer. I don't mind assisting her with the diabetes because I've been a diabetic for 10 years, but for crying out loud, she needs to have accessible equipment. She wants to be able to test her blood sugar independently. So,
you know, one of the things that, you know, Linda and I work on structured negotiations efforts. It's Disability Rights Advocates works on healthcare issues. DREDF works on healthcare issues. The folks in LA at the yeah, DRLC. So we're trying to do a little more coordination, and I bring that up because I know DREDF is specifically looking at Medi-Cal issues such as the one that you're mentioning, and we're hoping to have a little more coordination and can, you know, share it with CCB as we learn it. But we, that, yeah.
And also Medi-Cal is cutting back on services. Our podiatrist, through the kindness of her heart, is treating Jackie for free because podiatry is being cut. Medi-Cal has never paid for podiatry services at all. So if there is any way us as a state affiliate can move on with giving Medi-Cal a shove and other stuff, we would appreciate it. So anyway, I live here in both of us live here in Sacramento. If you can give somebody, maybe I could meet with you guys and we can give you our phone number. Maybe we can exchange ideas because Medi-Cal is terrible.
Jackie,
really,
let me
is.
Just address that point. Just yesterday at the Capitol, we were there. I wasn't, but so many of our members, about 30 of you, were, among other things, advocating for that very thing, to try and prevent the ending of outpatient podiatry services completely, which is being proposed for the beginning of this coming fiscal year. And this organization is fighting hard to prevent that from happening. So you've hit upon a very important item. And Jackie, we're going to use you as an advocate, so you've just stuck your foot in your mouth, so we're going to get you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, wait, we got a couple more questions.
Mr. President, one of the triumphs has been accessible voting machines. I live in Berkeley. Neither Bank of America nor Washington Mutual people have been able to work the machine. I mean, I have to go into the bank, find someone who has a headset, walk out of the bank, and get instruction from the person from the bank and how the machine works. It has never been successful. Not once. I've been trying it for 3 years. My question is if we can have a straw poll, if anyone else, how many people have been successful in withdrawing from ATMs here in the room?
Yeah, I think many of us have, yeah. But it is a training issue, and maybe one of you two ladies can address that.
Well, the other thing is, and, you know, I have some of our... I don't know if Linda has cards. I brought some cards. You guys can come up, and so you'll have my phone and email. You know, it is true. Sometimes you can walk into Bank of America right now has about 12,000 talking ATMs in the United States, and sometimes you can walk in a branch, and nobody there knows what the hell you're talking about. So, you know, we probably talk to Bank of America people down in North Carolina once a month. These issues come up, and you should feel free to contact us. And we ask for individual training, and we identify a branch that you need more training at this place. And they want to hear it. I mean, they want to hear it. So we need to hear from you. Linda?
Hello, good friends. This is Linda from San Francisco. I'd like to bring up the topic of Trader Joe's. I know that you guys signed an agreement with Trader Joe's almost a year and a half ago now, and it became clear that they had to do some computer reorganization of their cash register services in order to install keypads. Now, my question is a provocative one.
Why has it taken so long?
No. When do you decide to go back and say, are these folks bargaining in good faith or not?
Okay, that is a good and fair question. And for those of you who didn't hear Linda's full question, Trader Joe's did sign an agreement with the CCB and the ACB and the AFB over a year ago, and all the stores should have had the tactile point-of-sale devices by now. They do not have them yet, but I can tell you, we talk to Trader Joe's at least once a week, and I think at this point it's fair to say they want it as much as the people in this room. And the most recent, you know, down at CSUN, Mitch and Donna and some other people and I sat down and were like, what, you know, how long do we, just like Linda said. And we went back to them and we said, you know, enough is enough. Maybe we need to go to Plan B. And the guy, I swear the guy's like crying to us, practically. So the latest news is this. As of this week, they have the tactile point of sale device running in two stores in Southern California in four lanes. They have been unable until then to get them up and running without crashing down the lane. We will find out on Monday whether they feel confident enough to come up here on Wednesday, up here being the Bay Area, and actually I'm glad, Linda, you raised that, because they want a couple people, and if anyone's in the Bay Area can come with us on Wednesday, either it'll
Alameda.
Be...
Alameda.
What?
It's going to be either Alameda or Emeryville, I think.
Alameda or El Cerrito on Wednesday. We'll know on Monday, and I'll put something out on the the CCB list, and you guys can do with it as you wish. I don't know what to say. I think they really are in good faith. I think they had unbelievable logistics issues with these things.
Yeah, just colossal software problems. It's really, we've never had this kind of problem with anyone else before. In terms of...
Well, I said L.A. because I don't really know my geography. They're in Monrovia. Yeah. And I think they test them in the stores closest to their headquarters so they can run back and forth. Oh, I'll find out on Monday we'll find out which lanes they're in, and we'll let Donna know, and she can let all you guys down there know. But, yeah.
Okay, we have one more questioner. Lewis, the last one.
First of all, I want to say congratulations for all the hard work that you've been doing over the years. And secondly, when we make assumptions... Now, I've heard you say things about accessible or talking prescription bottles, things of this nature. But along with those prescription bottles comes that, you know, that little pamphlet that's telling you all about the medication. I'm wondering whether or not that will also be accessible. That's one thing. I don't want to make the assumption that you were talking about all accessibility to everything. And secondly, I'd like to ask, if you had to tell us, say, three common assumptions that we make that we really should not make, what would they be in concern with our medications or medical related? Will the prescriptions, the information also include the pamphlet information telling you about the medication? I've never actually seen one, but they are always in the bag along with the medication.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, those are really good questions. In terms of assumptions, I wouldn't venture to guess anybody else's assumptions, so I might have to pass on that. But in terms of the information that comes with a prescription, our ability through structured negotiations is to get things that we can say the ADA or California law requires a government entity or a private corporation to effectively communicate that information. So in terms of prescriptions, the detailed pamphlet that comes in the box, that is produced by the drug manufacturer. So we can't reach that drug manufacturer through structured negotiations because there's no ADA right, at least that we're aware. I mean, we're open to, you know, further research on this. Right now, the effort is for the label itself because the pharmacists are printing those labels in their store. So they are choosing, our analysis is that they are choosing to take information and put it into standard print. And when they make that choice, they need to say, not everybody reads standard print. We need to put this information in other formats. The one-page patient information sheet that comes in the bag, that might also be printed in some instances by the pharmacy itself. We think we have our best shot at those things that are printed in the pharmacy. Now, we're here to tell you that no one has yet said we will negotiate with you over this. So what we're talking about here is our hopes for advocacy, and part of this session, what our hopes for advocacy are. I will say this, we're trying to also be in touch with advocates around the, not just the country, but you know, in other countries about this too. And in the European Union, the drug manufacturers are doing this thing where there's a centralized 800 number and you can just call it up and put in your drug and they'll read that whole thing. So there's lots of ideas out there for advocacy on this issue. Thank you.
Okay. You know, I'm going to just ask everybody a question. Aren't we lucky in California to have these ladies on our side? I think that's all I need to say.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay, so like I said, I have some cards. Should I give out our phone?
Yeah.
Yeah, people, you know, email is the best way to reach us. Let me just say one thing about contacting us about stuff. The more detail you have, the better for the issue. If you go somewhere and have a problem, when did you go, you know, what was the exact problem? Not just a generalized thing, like I don't get my insurance information, but who's your company? When's the last time you got a statement?
And if you've complained to them, who you complained to and what they said in response.
Very important. Before you even think about us, be your own advocate. Because as lawyers, we can't get anywhere unless you've already tried to advocate for yourself. Thanks a lot for including us in your program. We really appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to have some cards in the back for Michael Marlin, and maybe Lynn and Lainey, you have guys have cards as well. But why don't you give your emails?
My email is LF, my initials, Lainey Feingold, LF at LFlegal.com. And that will remind you to check out my new website, which is LFlegal.com.
You mean I got to change my contact?
And mine, this is Linda.
One second, my old email still works, so if you have that, you don't need to learn the new one.
And for Linda, my email address is LDAR, short for Linda Dardarian, LDAR at GDBLegal.com. GDBLegal.com.
Let's give them one more rousing hand. Thank you both very much for coming
out
today.
And we count on all of you keeping us in business, too. So.
And on our toes.
All right. This session is hereby adjourned. We'll see you at 7 o'clock. And remember all the meetings coming up.